bit noisy for all of us.
Okay, so it's April 21st, 2012 in London with the Ponda Vasena girls. A lot of you are like way too old to be in Ponda Vasena. Aren't you?
Yeah. There's no mentorship system.
Oh.
So we're allowed to be older than that.
Are you all mentors here?
No, the majority.
Okay.
There's a few mentees.
There's mentees. Such a funny word. Mentees reminds me of like manatees. Mentees. You know what a manatee is?
Yeah.
Do any of you know what a manatee is?
What?
A manatee? They're kind of like a walrus. People say mentee. Always reminds me of manatee. Oh, are we curious? You want to get over there? You can go this way. Right, look, you can walk this way. There you go. All right, well, it's really interesting, actually, what you said. I think I'm going to start a little differently than I had planned. So we're talking about how to get high-quality sadhana done, even when we're very busy with our work and our school and our family and our services. And I really like what you said about the fact that we tend to get recognition and encouragement for doing service and not for sadhana. You know, I cannot recall the last time anybody even said to me, Urmila, do you chant your 16 hours and your 3 gayatri? Or anybody ever praised me for that? Or anything, you know, that anyone even discusses that with me. Yeah, you know, I just can't recall a time when anyone said, wow, it's really wonderful that you raised a family and ran a school and you always got your rounds and your gayatri done. You know, never. It just hasn't happened. The kind of things people will say is, oh, it's so wonderful you published books, or it's so wonderful that you've done this, or it's so wonderful that you've done that. And you know, in management, one of the things we learn, management and leadership, is that people will only do what's measured. Did you know that? That means either someone else has to measure it or you have to measure it. If nobody's measuring it, if no one external to you is measuring it, and if you're not measuring it yourself, you'll stop doing it. It's got to be on your list or on somebody's list. And I do think it's a fact that in most of ISKCON, we tend to de-emphasize the basic sadhana as far as something that we recognize people for. If you're going to look at organizational culture, do any of you know what organizational culture is?
Culture that's organized?
Culture that's organized. Okay. The culture that an organization has. And by culture, we mean, what are the values? What are the things that are values? What are the norms? How do people behave with each other? So how is culture established in an organization? It's established by stories. What stories do people tell? What gets recognized? Who are the heroes and who are the villains? Every organization has heroes and villains. How the leaders and the members deal with the crises. How do they react to some kind of a crisis? And what kind of symbols are there? And those are the things that establish for the members what are the norms, what are the values. So a long time ago, I mean actually in the very, very beginning of the movement, there wasn't such an emphasis on sadhana. The devotees didn't have an organized morning program and they were chanting their rounds just kind of whenever. And within a few years in ISKCON, we had an organized morning program and we had a japa time. And there are still some temples, except for example in Mayapur, where there's somebody keeping track as to who comes to Mangalarti. There's like a little attendance sheet for who comes to what thing of the morning program. And again, because it's being measured, as soon as you measure something, then it becomes important. But you'll notice that when we talk about devotees, when we glorify devotees, if you think about what kind of stories we tell and what we recognize, how often do we talk about sadhana? You know, we'll often talk about a person's character, how they deal with others, what kind of relationship they have with others, and we'll often talk about what services they've done, what kind of tangible results they've accomplished. And we very rarely talk about their sadhana. Sometimes, with someone like Ayendra, I noticed that was very often what was discussed about him. how he was so devoted to kirtan, how he chanted 116 rounds a day and so forth. But that's, you know, generally, again, that's not the kind of thing that's discussed. So it wasn't on my list here, but I'm very glad that you brought that up, because I think one of the most important things we can do to help ourselves and other people have good sadhana is to talk about it and to recognize it, to have it be something that we discuss, not in a prime way, but in an encouraging way. And I think any of us who've maintained strict sadhana for decades know that sometimes it's really easy and sometimes it's really hard. I haven't met very many people who could say it's easy every day. I've met a few people like that. I met a few people who were just extremely healthy and extremely regulated by nature. That for them, having good sadhana every day is just easy. But that seems to be the exception. I think for most of us, there are really easy days and really easy weeks and really easy months and maybe even really easy years, and there are times that it's really, really, really hard. I mean, I'd say the time for me in my life when it was the most difficult was the last year of my graduate studies. I was doing, foolishly or not, I was doing a master's and a PhD at the same time. And I was doing both of them together simultaneously in 3 years. Which, as I said, that's probably some sort of insanity. There's a lot of reasons why I was doing that. But anyway, the last year, I had to take some courses and write my thesis, and I had to do an internship, which was like having a full-time job. Most of you guys would say job. So I was doing a full-time job. And I was writing my thesis, and my thesis wasn't just writing in my field. It had to be research. It had to be original research. So, and I, again, rather foolishly, decided I was going to do some research that would benefit the ISKCON world, which I've since told anybody else doing a PhD, forget about benefiting the ISKCON world, just get your degree. So I surveyed every single teacher in every single Hare Krishna school in the world, which means I had to survey teachers in Manipur, India, and in little villages in Africa, which meant that I had to send them surveys which got lost, and then I had to call up the UPS and argue with them, and I had to call Africa and India at 3 in the morning my time, you know, get up at 3 in the morning, and before I even took a shower, I had to call somebody in Africa before it was too late there and say, you know, did you get the surveys? Oh, no, not the G, they haven't come yet. You know, I had to go the next day, and I had to be at work at 7:20 in the morning, and I remember it was a struggle. You know, there were times when I'd get to work and my boss would say, oh, by the way, we're having some meetings today after school. You're going to have to be here till 9 o'clock at night. And oops, I had some japa to chant, and I would take my beads and go out and hide in the school buses in the car park and finish my rounds there. So, I mean, I had times like that. I mean, I had times when it was just easy, just a part of my schedule and a part of my life, and everything was going well. But I do think that's one thing we could do for each other, is give also some recognition for that and some notice of that and some talking about that. Because as far as our external accomplishments, you know what? We're not the only doer, and we're not really capable of controlling the results of our actions. Have you noticed that? You all noticed that? So, you know, we can plan to build a temple or build a school or write a book, but it might not happen. That's not something that I have really any control over. I have some, I won't say any, but I really don't. And if I'm being given recognition and I'm being given encouragement for that kind of thing, instead of my real devotion, it's going to push me in the wrong direction. It's going to push me in the direction of actually a fruit of mentality in the name of bhakti. Because Krishna isn't all that concerned about those sort of external things anyway. I mean, it's nice to encourage people to open temples and distribute a certain number of books, and Prabhupada was interested in that. But if that's the main thing that people are putting themselves against, Jiva Goswami says that considering your achievements in devotional service to be equivalent to your advancement is a sign of intentional inattentive chanting. It's actually a sign of being fallen. If you're thinking the measure of my bhakti is my external accomplishments. How many artiques have I done? How many books have I distributed? How many temples have I opened? You know, it's not that much different from the non-devotee thinking, you know, how much money have I made? How many things have I done in my life? You know, for most people, that's what their biography is made up of. That's what their obituary is made up of, their accomplishments. And if we're pushing like that in bhakti, we're actually pushing people in a way that's not really favorable for them. First of all, not everybody is, how can we say, driven to produce big things. It's not everybody's interest. Second of all, it's not something that's completely under our control. We're only partially under our control. And second of all, and third of all, it can put us into a very external mood. And I think also a mood of thinking, let me sacrifice my own purification and my own sadhana and my own relationship with Krishna to do something that's more externally flashy. Anyway, I'm very glad you brought that up. And we'll return to that. So I wanted to look at, you know, how do we, what do we consider, and this is going to relate to this as well, but what do we consider to be a successful life? How do we consider that, okay, my life has become successful? How do we judge successful life? How do we know whether our life was successful or not? Yes.
We're developing taste for chanting.
A taste for chanting. And she'd like to know, Thakur says two things. You know the two things? Namruchi and, do you know the other one? Jivadvaya. So how much we have a taste for the name and for all of our service, not only for chanting. And how much we're kind to other living entities. That's really a successful love. Any other measures of success? To realize yourself? Yes. How much we're realizing ourselves? I mean, it's lovely to talk about. I'm not this body. I'm not this body. I'm a soul. I'm a servant of Krishna. But we want to experience that. We don't want to just go on saying that for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. At a certain point, we want to start to see who we are as a soul. Okay? Yes?
To be content.
Ah, okay. To be content with what?
With where, to be satisfied with what you're putting in to your daily endeavors or whatever it is, and what, like, in a sense, what you're getting back as well.
Okay, so let's say I hate to say that there's a material side to our life, but let's say to be content with those sort of things. To be content with, I'd say to be content with who I am in this life. What kind of body I have, what kind of personality I have, what kind of inclinations I have. You know, what happens if we're not content with those things?
Is it important for devotees to be content with who they are in this life to be able to be successful in spiritual life?
I think so. I think it's actually essential. Because we only have so much human energy, and if you put your energy into trying to change your personality, I'm not talking about changing, we should try to change how we exhibit our personality, but not try to change our personality itself. Do you know the difference? Do you understand the difference between those two things? Between changing how you exhibit your personality and trying to change your personality itself?
Who you are, your authentic self, may be different from the image that you project, perhaps.
Maybe. I think of it more that each of us has a certain nature and a certain tendency in this life. A certain way that we're, sort of our default value of how we behave and who we are and how we view the world. And that's not going to change in this life, except under very extraordinary situations. But how, what we do with that, do we use it for Krishna? I mean, that's the basic thing Krishna's telling Arjuna. You can't change your nature, but you can determine whether you use it for Krishna or for illusion. I mean, one of the simple examples I give of this is that some of us are more inclined to be risk takers, and some of us are more inclined to be cautious. And if we're a cautious type person, we're probably going to be a cautious type person. That's probably not going to change. And if we're a risk-taking kind of person, we're probably going to stay a risk-taking kind of person. That's probably not going to change. But what you're cautious about and what you take risks about can change. So you're going to, you know, if a person may take risks by taking drugs and alcohol and driving around fast on a weekend night, or a person may take risks by going to preach in Saudi Arabia. So it's the same mentality, but what you do with it will be very different. How you exhibit it, what you use it for. But our basic tendency, just like some of us in this room are very comfortable getting in front of a group of people and speaking, and some of us aren't. I've noticed in any group, probably about 60% of the people will never say a word. And as soon as you break up into smaller groups and you've got like 5 or 6 people, then those people often talk. And a lot of that is just who we are. Some of us are more outgoing and some of us are more reserved. So again, that kind of thing is not going to change. What do you use your reserved nature for? What do you use your outgoing nature for? That will change. That we can change. Or some of us really are energized by being with a lot of people. Some of us, you know, would prefer to work on some task and not be with a lot of people all the time. And that kind of thing also is not going to change. But what we do with it can change. So yeah, to be content with who I am in this life, what kind of body I have, especially women, we tend to not be content with our bodies. You know, to think, well, I'm not beautiful enough. I wish I had, you know, better this or more of this, less of that. Okay? Little different shape of this or whatever. Different color of this. And those sort of desires, they're not insignificant desires. If we cultivate those desires, what will they bring us?
Envy.
Definitely envy of people who have bodies different from ours. And also?
Another body.
You know, if you're really thinking, oh, I wish I had a different colored hair, and I wish it was thicker or thinner or curlier or straighter. I wish my nose was smaller or bigger. I wish my eyes were bigger or smaller, you know. I wish I was fatter. I wish I was skinnier. I wish I was taller. I wish I was shorter. I wish I was this. I wish I was that. Then that we're building that desire for another body. And the same thing with our personality. If we're thinking, oh, I wish I could be more quiet and just sit in the back of the room and not say anything. Or if we're thinking, oh, I wish I could get up in front of the room and talk. Then you can get a chance to do that in another life. Does that make sense to everybody? So to be content. This is the kind of body I have in this life. This is the kind of nature I have in this life. And the kind of karma we have in our life. You know, some of us have better karma for health than others. Some of us have better karma for education, for money, for our family relationships. Does that make sense to everybody? And some of that you can adjust to some extent in this life, and some of it you can't. And again, if we're thinking, I wish I had this, I wish I had that, if only I had this, if only I had that, then we go to another body. So yeah, I think being content is a very important thing. Yeah.
Less material attachments, less material desires.
Okay, can we put that positively?
More love for Krishna.
Okay, more spiritual desires. So, successful life means that I have intense attachment and love for Krishna. Material attachment basically means various varieties of envy of Krishna. That's what we mean by it. Material attachment doesn't so much mean I'm attached to my car. It means I'm attached to enjoying separately from Krishna. Attached to my car usually means I think my car is my shelter. I think my car is going to fulfill my desires. It's more a symptom. Do you understand? If I'm envious of Krishna, the symptoms will show up that I get attached to things separately from Krishna. I get attached to my body, I get attached to my mind, I get attached to my family, I get attached to my car. What do you mean by attached to them? that I think that they're my shelter. I think that they're supplying me what I need. They're completing me. I have to have my this or my that in order to feel like a whole person, in order to get my needs met. So that's what we mean by a material attachment. So if I'm fully attached to Krishna, then I know that Krishna's meeting all my needs. Now, Krishna may meet my needs by giving me a car, or giving me a pair of shoes, or giving me a sari, or giving me nice friends, or giving me a job that uses my propensities, or whatever. But I'm not thinking that the job, or the car, or the friends, or the sari is what's meeting my needs. It's Krishna that's meeting my needs. So that's successful life. When I have all of my attachments, all of my investments in Krishna. There's birds in this one. All right. So our successful life is really how much do I fall in love with Krishna? How much do I become attached with Krishna? Which will then leave me with contentment with my material situation. I'm not going to be interested in changing my material situation. Whatever it is, it is. It becomes basically irrelevant. Whatever material situation I have, I'll use that in Krishna's service. But I'm not thinking my material arrangement is my shelter. Okay. What's the role of sadhana in achieving... Yes. Is that Radha Krishna? Why does Radha Krishna sound like a bird? That is the strangest toy. Where did that toy come from? From Gujarat. That is really odd. It's Radha Krishna when you shake them, they sound like birds. Radha Krishna. Okay. How is our sadhana related to our success in life? Yes.
I don't know if it's the right answer, but
there's not necessarily like one right answer. Okay. There might be at least 20 right answers.
I'm thinking it might be that sadhana, you need to sort of perfect your sadhana bhakti first before you turn to spontaneous loving devotion.
Okay. So before we get to the platform of spontaneous loving devotion, we have to perfect our sadhana. Okay, that's a very nice answer. So our sadhana is talking about practice. And what are we practicing in our sadhana? What is it we're practicing to do? To think of Krishna. We're practicing to think of Krishna with love. That's what we're practicing. Sadhana bhakti is also called abhyas yoga or practice yoga. And abhyas literally means repetition. You know, whenever you're practicing something, anything, you repeat it over and over again. Isn't that the fact? Anything you're practicing to do? Any other ideas of how our sadhana relates to our successful life?
Well, it attracts Krishna's mercy and attention, which is ultimately what perfects our life.
Mm, that's beautiful. Yes, I really like one of my favorite verses is where Lord Kapiladev says that we use the mind as a hook to capture the Lord. So really what we're doing in sadhana is we're practicing or repeating thinking about Krishna with love, using the mind, which then attracts Krishna to manifest himself, which is beyond, who is beyond the mind. So Krishna is not on the platform of mind. But if we don't practice absorbing our mind in Krishna, he's not going to be very interested to manifest himself. Very nice. Other ideas about the relationship of our sadhana to our successful life? Yes. Yes.
A little bit illusory, but you know when you the sense of achievement that comes from like doing your sadhana nicely in the morning or something like that.
Mm.
It's a little bit illusory because it's not what we're aiming to do from our sadhana.
Well, it depends on how you're looking at that. If you think of sadhana as some kind of accomplishment that's done out of willpower and thinking on the doer, then I'd say that's illusory. You know, I am the 16-round chanter. I have done that. And Krishna's expert is showing you that you're not the doer, by the way. He's really good. He'll put you in some situation where you're really sick or something and you can't get your rounds done. And then you realize that you're getting your sadhana done by his grace also, not just because you're the doer. He'll put you in some situation where you just can't. Or where it's really difficult for you. And you'll see that it's mercy. But I think that there's a genuine kind of satisfaction in fulfilling our vows, in being true to our vows, and serving our guru, and serving Krishna, and doing what we said that we would do. I think that's a sort of genuine sort of satisfaction. I don't think that's a kind of pride. I consider that to be something authentic, very authentic. I mean, after all, what we're trying to do in sadhana, one of the things we're trying to do, is we're trying to show Krishna that we're trustworthy. You're talking about Krishna revealing himself. There's many reasons why he'll be attracted to reveal ourselves, and to reveal himself to us. And one reason is that we show him that we mean what we say. Anybody can, and people do this all the time, not just in Krishna consciousness, but in Christianity, in Islam, and any other religion of the world. Where people will talk about, I love God. Oh yes, I love God, I'm a religious person, I care about God, I love Krishna. But what does that mean? Just like if I tell any of you, oh I love you, but I won't do anything for you. There's no meaning to it. You know, I've had some friends like that, where they say, yes, Ramila, I'm your friend, and then anytime I actually need something, they're not there. And after a while, you figure, well, they're not much of a friend. They're sub-emotional something, but nothing really. So part of our sadhana is showing Krishna, you know, you can trust me. I told you I'm going to be with you every day, and I'm going to be with you every day. Like if you tell somebody, you know, I'm going to pick you up at 6 o'clock. I had a student once in our school that the parents would always come late to pick him up. And even though he knew that they'd always come late, it was difficult for him. All the other parents would come on time and he's there waiting. And his parents would be an hour late or 2 hours late. All the time. And it hurt. So we're saying to Krishna, okay, this is my time to be with you. I've often thought about sadhana as our time to be just with Krishna instead of running around doing things for Krishna. And if we think again about people that we love, you know, those of you who are married, so I'm sure you're happy that your husband does things for you, but you also want for him to just be with you. You don't want him just only doing things for you. So if you never saw your husband for a month because he was always working so hard and you said, well, I'm working hard to make the money to maintain you. And you said, well, that's lovely, dear, but I didn't marry you for money. I married you for you. Prabhupada talks about one man he knew who would go to work before his child woke up in the morning and come back after his child was sleeping in the evening when his child was 3 years old. He saw his father one time and he said to his mother, Mommy, who's that man? So that's not the kind of... Anybody want a marriage like that? When any woman say, I want to marry a man that I'll never see. You know, how do you have a relationship like that with somebody? You want to spend some time just being with them. Not necessarily even doing anything in particular. So I see sadhana as a time to just be with Krishna. And not trying to accomplish something. I'm not running around doing something for him. I'm just being with him. So it's a way of telling Krishna, you know, you can trust me. And I told you, Krishna, that I'm going to spend this time with you every day, and I'm going to do it. I mean, seriously, how many people have we met in our life who said they would do this or that, and they don't do it? And after a while, you may still like them, but how close of a relationship are you going to have with them? You may not dislike them. So we want Krishna to be interested in reviving a close relationship with us. So what does our sadhana do for us? I was thinking it gives us clear vision. So Krishna talks about this when he says in the four nutshell verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Anybody know the four nutshell verses of the Bhagavad Gita? 10, 8, 9, 10, 11. Can anybody recite the Sanskrit for 10, 8? I am the source of all spiritual material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their heart. And the next one, 10:9. Machita. Machita pranam. Bodhyantas prasparam. Katayantas chamanajam. Tushanti cha ramanti cha. So the devotees are always talking about me with each other, which gives them great satisfaction and bliss. Another one of those wonderful verses that shows that Krishna wants us to enjoy our service. You have that question a lot. Is it okay if we enjoy our service? Well, Krishna likes the fact that you enjoy your service. He wants you to enjoy your service. That's sort of the whole point. So they get great satisfaction and bliss from enlightening one another and conversing about me. You know, what does our sadhana mean? It means we're coming together to chant. We're chanting Krishna's name. We're hearing the scripture and discussing the scripture together. We're taking prasadam together. That's what we mean by sadhana. And then how does Krishna reciprocate? So when the devotees are meditating on him, when they're talking about him, when they're feeling some happiness doing so, what's the next one? So, Buddha Yoga gives us intelligence. And the next one? 10:11. Jnana-dipena, what does that mean?
Torchlighted
knowledge. So, he lights up our heart with knowledge. We get clear visions. I've been telling this story lately because it just happened to me recently in Tirupati. So we had a guide showing us around Tirupati, and we had a driver. And we were there in the winter. So in the winter in India, it's often foggy. And we were in this car, and it looked like it was really foggy. And at a certain point, I realized that it wasn't really that foggy outside. It was just that there was condensation on the windshield, and the driver wasn't cleaning the inside of the windshield. So, I used to think maybe the Indian cars just didn't have the right gizmos, but I found they did. The drivers just don't use them. So you know what it is. You can set the heat to windshield.
Yeah.
My tentative conclusion is that these drivers must think that it costs money. I mean, they know that running the AC costs a lot of money. So they probably think that, and they know that running a heater inside their house costs a lot of money, so they're probably thinking that if I run the heater in the car, it costs a lot of money, not realizing that it's just pulling heat from the engine that's being wasted, otherwise doesn't cost a penny. So the guy didn't want to turn it on. And I was leaning forward and turning it on, and he would turn it off. And I'm a little assertive. I would turn it on again, and he would turn it off. And this went on, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, and finally I told our guy, I said, tell him to pull over to the side of the road, and we're not going anywhere until he cleans off the window, because we couldn't see.
Yeah.
So finally the guy surrenders, you know, under duress. And I kept telling our guide and translator, I said, tell him it doesn't cost anything. And I'm sure he was thinking these crazy Americans. And then, you know, the back windshield, I could see the back windshield had those wires in it, because
yeah,
that was also all foggy. And I said, do you have a button to clean the back windshield? He said, no, it's broken. because I didn't believe it. So I actually got out of the back seat, and I looked in the front, and I said, there's the button right there. I said, let's see if it works. So I pushed it. I'm sorry, I'm really American. So I pushed it, and of course it worked. And I said, if you're not going to turn those on, we're just sitting right here. So he turned them on, and of course we cleaned the windshield, and then we could see. So often in our life, we're thinking that everything's just foggy. We don't know what to do, where to go. Should I marry this person? Should I get married at all? Should I go here? Should I go there? Should I get this degree? Should I have a child? Should I have another child? Should I do that? All these questions that we ask in our life. And we can't see. But if we want to see, we have to clean our windshield. The fog is within our own mind. Just like in this car, I really thought it was foggy outside. We were driving for a long way, and I just thought it was really foggy outside. And then when we got out of the car, I saw it's not foggy outside, it's inside the car. So the fog is in our own consciousness. That's where we're all clogged up. We were just saying the other night at Soho, how Prabhupada says that Krishna can become your direct advisor or Krishna can remain unknown according to your receptivity. So Krishna is in the heart and he's giving instructions with Tasmati Gyanam Upohanam Cha. So what's the ability to hear him? Prabhupada also talks about how there's radio waves and television waves, like right now in this room. There's radio waves and television waves. And if you have the right instrument, then you can pick them up. So Krishna's in the heart, and Prabhupada said many times, he's eager to talk to you. He's eager to see you. I mean, sometimes we might think that that's not true. Well, if Krishna's so eager to see me and talk to me, why is it so hard? But it's a question of whether or not we're receptive. We often think we're more receptive than we really are. So our sadhanas are primary means by which we clear our consciousness and by which we become receptive and we can see things clearly. And the more seriously, and by seriously I don't mean that you don't smile. I don't mean like that. But the more with determination and regularity and attention and care we do our sadhana, the more clear things become, the more we can understand things. Oh, that's what this is about. Oh, this is what it's about. I was talking to one Gurukuli who had a lot of doubts about Krishna consciousness, and then he started chanting japa. And he came to me afterwards, he said, oh, now that I'm chanting japa, all of my doubts have been resolved. Also, by having good sadhana, we get in touch with spiritual energy. We come under the shelter of Srimati Radharani. We get infused with spiritual energy. That doesn't necessarily mean that our physical health will improve and we can go running around 10 times more than we could have otherwise. Although it might. But that doesn't necessarily mean that. But it means that we have a lot more enthusiasm for our spiritual life. The more that you do sadhana, again, not just ritualistically, the more you do it with care and attention, the more determination and energy you have for your spiritual life in general. And that means also for all our other services. If we think, I'm so busy with this service, and I'm so busy with my family, and I'm so busy with my work, and I'm so busy with my school, that I don't have the time and energy for attentive sadhana, we're putting things backwards. It's sort of like people who don't have time to eat healthy food. We see these people as they're running on the sidewalk from one place to another, they're eating some old processed food out of a little bag. Right? You see this? They buy their little, what do you call potato chips?
Crisps.
Okay, I said potato chips, you mean French fries. So they're eating their little crisps out of a bag, or their little processed whatever, full of all their... everybody knows nowadays that stuff is going to make you sick. But they're so busy that they don't have time to be healthy. Now, if you don't have time to be healthy, eventually you're going to lose the energy to be busy, aren't you? Eventually you're going to have to just be taking care of your health. So we're thinking, I'm so busy with this and with this and with this and with this. I don't have time for sadhana, or I don't have time for good quality sadhana, not realizing that doing good quality sadhana is what gives us the energy and drive and enthusiasm to do everything else in our lives. And then to clean our heart. Especially as you go on in Krishna consciousness, one really gets tired of having a dirty heart. You know, I think in the beginning we don't even know our heart's dirty. We think that we're wonderful and we're spiritual. But as you progress, you start saying, you know, I'm really full of all this stuff, isn't it? Don't you see that? Isn't this kind of discouraging? When you start seeing your real motives for things. Like we're thinking, well, I'm really like this or really like that. Ouch. So we get to purify our heart. And then the other nice thing about sadhana is it's the main means by which everything else in our life becomes connected with Krishna. Really, bhakti is the 9 processes of devotional service. Hearing about Krishna, talking about Krishna, or chanting, remembering Krishna, serving what's related to Krishna, like Krishna's devotees in holy places, worshipping Krishna, serving Krishna, becoming Krishna's friend, giving everything to Krishna. That's bhakti. Now what about all the other things we do? Taking a shower, brushing our teeth, feeding our babies, cleaning our house, going to work, going to school. What's all of that? Well, if you do that for Krishna, then that can also become as good as bhakti. Now, in and of itself, that stuff is just conditional material activities. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati describes those activities when offered to Krishna as gona karma, or subsidiary activities of bhakti. But Srila Prabhupada also talks about that when those things are dedicated to Krishna, they become as good as bhakti. And there's that wonderful purport in the 5th chapter of the 1st canto, how that anything, when used to glorify Krishna, is as good as Hare Kirtan. You all know that verse. He talks about psychology, chemistry, poetry, fiction. If used to glorify Krishna, is as good as Hare Kirtan. But what allows us to have it so that changing our babies' nappies and driving to work and brushing our teeth and serving our husbands and cleaning our floor becomes just as good as chanting Hare Krishna? Because those things are like iron that you put into the fire, and bhakti, the 9 processes of bhakti are like the fire. If you don't have any fire, what fire are you going to put the iron into? It's going to be very difficult to dedicate your work to Krishna and your school to Krishna and your household duties to Krishna and your basic bodily activities to Krishna if you don't have a fire of sadhana. What fire are you going to put the iron into to make it hot? Years ago, somebody asked me, how do I think of Krishna at work? I said, well, start by thinking about Krishna when you're chanting. You know, it's very, very difficult to connect everything we're doing with Krishna if we don't have a connection with Krishna. Just like I have devices that I can charge from my computer. I have an MP3 player I can charge from my computer. I have an e-reader I can charge from my computer. But my computer's got to be charged. If I don't have my computer charged, I can't charge anything from it. So to spiritualize your life without doing sadhana, basically forget it. One way, it'll be some sort of a hallucination. I'm working for Krishna, I'm going to school for Krishna, I'm doing my family activities for Krishna, but I haven't established my relationship with Krishna. Could you imagine someone saying that they're doing something for you when you hardly even know them? How is that possible? How would they know what you like? You have to have a relationship with somebody before you can be doing things for them. I mean, you can do some things for Krishna in a simple beginning way without having a relationship with Krishna. We can start that way. So even people who have no sadhana, they can start and do some work for Krishna as a beginning. as a way of entering into bhakti, but really deeply entering into bhakti, you have to have a relationship. It has to be sambandha before you can have abhidhaya. Right? How are you going to establish sambandha without sadhana? Sambandha is relationship. And abhidhaya is acting on that relationship. And prayoga is the goal. How are you going to act on your relationship with Krishna unless you have a relationship with Krishna? So sadhana is the main thing that's establishing our relationship with Krishna. Again, in the beginning, if somebody comes, they can give some donation, they can give some time, and that's a good way to start. But the purpose of that is to bring them to sadhana. I can start to establish my relationship with you by doing things for you. Just a very simple example. I mean, if someone doesn't really know me, and this happens all the time, if someone doesn't really know me, they'll give me things that I don't need and don't want. I'm sure it happens to you guys too, right? People who don't really know you. I remember one time at my son's birthday party, this is when he was an adult, someone gave him a China dog. And we were looking at it later, you know, my son and his wife and their older kids and I were talking about it. Why would anyone think he wanted a China dog? And he has a lot of little kids. Oh, the China dog would become China dust very soon. China powder. And he's just not the kind of person that has a bunch of knickknacks in his house. So when people don't know us, we may accept their sentiment that they want to do something for us. But they can't really do something for us. Someone has to know me first and know what I like and have some relationship with me before they can really do something for me. Although it is true that by trying to do something for me, that may be a way of establishing a relationship. So people can try to do some service for Krishna under the direction of other devotees, even before sadhana. But by sadhana, we really get to know Krishna. We get to know our relationship with Krishna. And then the things we do for Krishna are much more meaningful. I mean, when people know me well, then they can do things for me that are very meaningful. And they'll take the time to say, what do you need? What do you want? Before just doing something for me. And sometimes it's even disturbing when people do things for us that we don't want and don't need. We don't quite know what to do with it. Does that make sense to everybody? So if we're so busy with all the activities we're doing for Krishna, but we're not establishing our relationship with Krishna by sadhana, then a lot of those things we're doing for Krishna may not be really pleasing to Krishna. I mean, still he'll accept that as something, but it's not establishing our relationship with Krishna in the way that we would want. All right, now let's look at some problems that people have if they are really attached to some regular, high-quality sadhana. So sometimes, in the name of having high quality sadhana, we neglect the other aspects of our life. I've heard from a number of men, they say, you know, it can be really difficult to be married to a woman who's initiated and stricter about her vows because you come home from work and dinner's not made because she's still finishing her vows. You know, the house is a mess and nothing's cooked. And I'll probably got to finish my rounds. So not that sadhana means that the rest of my life is useless. Of course, we see this with service also. We see people, and both men and women do this, you know, that in the name of doing a lot of service, I neglect my family or I neglect my health or... I think that service means a particular kind of service. I think service means I have to go to the temple and address the deities. Service means I have to cook for the deity. Service means I have to distribute books and let everything else just fall apart. And of course, in the long run, that doesn't usually work. In the long run, that side of our life ends up reasserting itself. And also in the name of service and getting our sadhana done, we can mistreat others. We can mistreat others emotionally. No, well, I've got to get the service done for Guru, or I've got to get my rounds done, leave me alone. So our sadhana should not be used as an excuse to be neglectful, be inconsiderate, be unkind. Alright, so we talked about principles. So how are we going to do this? So what I'm going to say now is going to be a little radical. But I'm famous for being radical, so I guess you already knew when you invited me here that you were risking getting that. So it's a very nice demonstration. Some of you might have seen it, and if you haven't seen it, you can find some of it on YouTube. So you take two containers, equal size, and if you have a pile of big rocks and a pile of small rocks and a pile of sand and a cup of water, and you want to fit it in the containers, what do you have to do? You got to start with the big stuff. If you fill your container up with water, there's no room for anything else. So if you first put in the big rocks and then you put in the little rocks will fill the spaces between the big rocks. And then you put in the sand will fill the spaces between the little rocks. And then you can also put in some water. So if you start with the most important things, you'll be able to do a lot more than if you start with the less important things. It just seems to be the way life works. Another thing I realized many years ago when I used to have a physical inbox, now that I travel all the time, I only have an electronic inbox. But I used to have an actual little plastic box on my desk with papers in it of things that I had to take care of. And every once in a while, every couple months or so, I would go through the whole box and go through all the papers. And every time I did that, there would be some things that had expired that I couldn't do anymore, that the time for doing them was over. And what I realized was that somehow or other life went on. Somehow or other, there were certain things I just never got to, they never got done, and there was no crisis. And I figured out that it wasn't true that every single thing I thought I needed to get done at all. That was kind of revolutionary. Another interesting thing I figured out is that that each of us only has the energy to do a certain number of things to a high level of quality. It is basically impossible to do every single thing in our life to the highest possible level of quality. We just don't have the time or the energy or the resources to do that. So we have to decide what things in my life am I going to do to a very high level of quality. What things am I going to do to a medium level of quality? What things am I going to do to a low level of quality? And what things am I not going to get done at all? And by the way, it's all right to not get certain things done at all. It actually is. So it's good to make a very conscious determination. And also it can change. Maybe you're cleaning your house to a low level of quality 6 days a week, and 1 day a week you clean your house to a high level of quality. Or maybe you cook acceptable meals 3 days a week and you cook wonderful meals 4 days a week. You make a decision, okay, what am I, because we only have a certain amount of energy. You know, if I'm going to spend 6 hours a day in the kitchen making a gourmet meal like you find in a fancy restaurant every single day, I'm not going to have a whole lot of energy left over to do all the other things I want to do. So, you know, maybe you do that sometimes, but not necessarily every single day. And you have to get every single bit of dust off every single surface in your house every single day. If you have to do that, you probably need to hire a maid. Unless you have a very small house with hardly any furniture in it. So that's another way to do things. Simplify your life. I remember, you know, my husband and I were such austere grahastas. We practically speaking had no furniture. I think we had a sofa for maybe like 5 months of our whole grahasta life. We rarely had any furniture. We had one rocking chair, you know, a desk and chairs. We never had like nice chairs to sit in. And the one benefit of that is there was not very much to clean. So I remember one time we actually bought like outdoor furniture, you know, the stuff you put outside is just made of plastic. And we had that for inside. One of our relatives was visiting and said, oh, early outdoor. So that can also be something. If you find that your life is eating up all of your energy, you can also simplify your life. You know, do you really need all those things? Sometimes you go to homes where there's, you know, 40 sets of deities, for example. So I've been to houses like that. 5 sets of Radha Krishna deities, 4 sets of Gaudiya, 3 sets of Jagannath, 100 Shilas. Have you been to houses like this?
No.
But I have. You know, very, very complicated. Or houses where they have a temple standard of deity worship, where they're doing 5 offerings and artiks a day and changing the deity's clothes twice a day, and that's all they can do. May decide, well, maybe I don't have to do all of those things. Maybe I don't have to have such a complicated life. Maybe I don't have to sign up for 10 different services at the local temple. Maybe I don't have to say yes to everything everybody asks me to do. There was a while in India where I was staying with my daughter and I was chanting a lot of rounds every day, but when we went into Vrindavan, we would go into Vrindavan for a festival, and then I'd see all my old friends, and they'd always want to talk to me. So I had a friend who was living in Vrindavan and chanting 64 rounds a day, and I said, how do you chant 64 rounds a day in Vrindavan? I said, I can see it's easy if you go out to Govardhan and there's nobody there, but here, I said, every 5 steps somebody's saying, hi, go to you, and this and that. And she said, I just go to them and said, you know, I really love you, but I need to finish my rounds. So I found that you can actually say to people, oh, I'd really like to do that, but I just can't do it. I'm so sorry. You know, I'd love to be able to do it. My schedule's already packed. And 99 times out of 100 people are satisfied with that. 1 time out of 100, they'll push. And then you can say, you know, I really would like to do it. I wish I could expand time. So it is possible to say no without offending people. Another thing to think about in terms of getting things done is the measure of our success in life is not how many things we've gotten done, even how many things we've gotten done for Krishna. We shouldn't be lazy. Devotional service doesn't mean just sitting down and meditating. It doesn't mean being active. But I've never read anywhere where our success in life is, you know, how much, how big. We should be active and use our propensities and our talents for Krishna, certainly. But it's not, you know, I have to do this, and I have to do that, and I have to do this, and I have to do that. And if you really want to think about how important what we do is, then take someone who's very near and dear to you and who really loves you and really cares about you and say, would you be willing to sit down for an hour and hear about everything I did today? Do we have anybody in our life like that that would be willing to listen for an hour to everything I did? I don't think so. Even I'm not interested in thinking about what I did for an hour. You know, I keep a journal, but I don't write down every detail of what I did. How boring. I wouldn't even want to read it. You know, and after we die, our whole life is going to be summarized probably in a few paragraphs. I mean, everything we've done, like you went online to see my biography. You know, so I'm almost 57 years old. So I've done a whole lot of things in 57 years. And how much do you find in Wikipedia? You know, 4 or 5 paragraphs. But if we get so caught up in the details of what we're doing, now we should try to do the details of what we're doing nicely because we're doing it for Krishna. Prabhupada said, whatever, we should think, whatever I'm meant to be doing, I'm doing, and let me do it with great care and attention for Krishna. But just to fill up our life with quantity? Why? You know, nobody's going to care. I'm not going to care. None of my friends and family are going to care. The world's not going to care. Nobody's going to care. It just, certainly Krishna's not going to care. It just doesn't matter. So to sacrifice our relationship with Krishna, to sacrifice our success in life just to build up a quantity of doing things is not very intelligent. When it just doesn't matter to anybody. So there will be some things in life that just don't get done. You know, one devotee wrote recently, you know, how can I make any plans when we're going to die at any moment? I said, well, you'll probably die in the middle of one of your plans. It's okay. Prabhupada left us without having finished translating the Bhagavatam. I mean, that's just what happens. You know, it's okay. That's not the point. Some things are not going to get done. If we're offering every minute to Krishna, it doesn't matter anyway. What I'm really offering is my love and my devotion and my endeavors. Really, Krishna's who's in charge of the result. And some things won't get done to a very high level of quality because it just can't. And that's also okay. You just can't be human otherwise. I mean, maybe if you only get like 3 things done a day, you could do all of them to a very high level of quality. So how do we keep our determination to have good sadhana? Well, I think for many devotees, their determination to have good sadhana goes up and down. So first of all, good friends. And it's nice to do our sadhana with friends and with family at least sometimes. It's difficult, not impossible, but it's difficult to always chant your rounds by yourself and always read by yourself and always have a kirtan by yourself. You can always invite somebody to your home once a week for a program in the morning. I found it was much easier to get up early and have a program if we invited somebody else to our house. And you knew they were going to show up at 5 o'clock, so you had to be up. You know, some sort of social push like that. And other people who care. And of course, there's always our virtual association. You can be part of a morning program over the internet. I don't know why it makes a difference, but it seems to make a difference whether it's in real time or recorded. I don't know why. I haven't figured it out. It shouldn't make a difference, but it does. So I had at one point in my life where I was going to 3 morning programs every day, 1 physically, 2 virtually. I did that for maybe a couple years. So I'd go to my local temple, and their morning program finished very early. Their whole morning program was over at 7:30, so I could get home and I could still get to it, you know, at least part of other programs. At least I was getting like Bhagavatam class and kirtan. I recently met somebody who's been a devotee for 20 years and has rarely visited a temple, and who for the last at least 5 years has been participating virtually. So a lot of places, even you can type in questions over email. So you can certainly do that. Another way to keep up determination in our sadhana is by getting rid of our energy vacuum cleaners, our spiritual energy vacuum cleaners. To be careful, especially what entertainment we have and what recreation we have, what hobbies we have. To try to get hobbies and entertainment and recreation that's related to Krishna. By the way, don't try to just eliminate all hobbies and recreation and entertainment for your life. That's not possible. Krishna says the yogis have to be temperate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation. And Prabhupada says there's 3 kinds of activities: emergency, ordinary, and desired. So we all have desired activities and we all have recreation. It's part of life. And if you think that I'm just not going to do anything that's recreation and I'm not going to do anything that's a hobby, you'll end up doing materialistic things. So to plan to do Krishna conscious enlivening things as your hobbies and your recreation, that will really help in your sadhana in general. Alright. We can have questions and discussions. Was that helpful? I hope something was helpful. And the children were remarkably well behaved. They don't have to be shit, it's okay. It's children's dharma to make noise. Yes. To make noise and to be distraction and make a mess. If they didn't do any of those, you'd think they were ill. Have to take them to the doctor. Yes.
In terms of doing other services or anything else, anything Krishna conscious,
think my main inhibition, it's not really to do so much with time. I know I can make time if I want to, but realistically I get more taste from doing other things. Like sometimes I might be able to remember Krishna more if I do something else, like if I'm reading Bhagavatam and working on Bhagavatam rather than...
But reading Bhagavatam, working on Bhagavatam is sadhana.
Okay, I mean in terms of like my japa, like in terms of concentrating on that. So I'd probably do other things around it because that...
What do you mean by other things? I'm not sure what you're saying.
So, like, for example, if I'm, you know, reading Bhagavatam or even discussing the Gita or...
But that is sadhana. Reading Bhagavatam and discussing the Gita is sadhana bhakti. No, but it is sadhana bhakti. There's nothing else it is other than sadhana bhakti.
Okay, and then, well, with other services as well, like, you know, any emailing stuff or any other stuff that I need to do, I need to get that out of the way first, and then when it comes down to sitting down to chant, I think because I've been so passionate with everything else, It's so hard to...
It's a really good idea to focus on things like japa and kirtan and bhagavatam first. Now, of course, Prabhupada said when he was a grihastha, he would chant 4 rounds before each meal and then another 4 rounds before he went to bed. But to have some time and some space where I'm not going to turn on the computer. I'm going to turn off my computer. I'm going to turn off my phone. I'm not going to do anything else. I mean, I think it's the same thing with your child or with your husband. You want to have times when you're just with them, when you're not being distracted by so many other things, isn't it? I mean, whether that's first thing in the morning or whether it's in the evening or whether it's at different times during the day, that's not really, that's something that you can work out for yourself. But be careful of thinking, first I've got to get this out of the way and then I can focus on Krishna. I mean, there may be some times when that's true. If there's something really urgent and really pressing that has to be taken care of immediately, and if you try to sit down and chant, that's going to be driving you nuts. But generally speaking, that can lead to a whole mentality of, you know, okay, first I've got to clean my house, then I've got to do this. Then, like Prahlad Maharaj talking to his friends and saying, you should be Krishna conscious. And I said, but first we have to do this, and then we have to do this, and then we have to do this. And when we're 80 years old, then we'll be Krishna conscious. You know, you can spend your whole life setting up to be Krishna conscious and never being Krishna conscious. It's kind of like if you said, okay, before I can cook, first I've got to clean the kitchen, and then I've got to shop, and then I've got to get the cookbooks, and then I've got to plan the meal. And suppose you were doing that for a week. You know, at a certain point, you just have to start cooking. Isn't it? And sometimes you just have to start cooking with whatever you have. So my general suggestion is, you know, put 10% of your energy into arranging your life to be Krishna conscious and 90% of your energy into just being Krishna conscious. But you don't want as a daily thing, first I got to do this, then I got to do this, and then I can chant. Then I can chant peacefully after I've got all that out of the way. But as the day goes on, it gets harder and harder to sit down and chant peacefully. I mean, one of the main things I suggest to people who have busy lives is you have to get up early. It makes such a big difference. Because when it's early, you don't have the mental pressure of getting stuff done. Once it gets to be about 7 or 8 in the morning, there's, you know, because the mode of passion kicks in then. And then you really start thinking, okay, I got to do this and I got to do this. And then just practical. The husband has to go to work or the kids have to go to school or you got to go to work. And there's all these things to do. It's definitely very helpful to get up early before there's this, I gotta do things. I was speaking with one devotee who has a young child and runs a business with her husband, and she was really unhappy in her life And it was because she was working on the business late at night and getting up late and chanting her rounds little here and there, in between this, under this, over this, around this. And she started going to sleep earlier, waking up earlier, getting all of her rounds done in the morning and doing some reading in the morning. She said that she brought me, she said, my happiness has increased by at least twice, double, just by doing that simple thing. Now, I'm not saying that that will work for everybody, but it can make a big difference. I hope that's sad. Okay. And, you know, at first, if you've been accustomed to doing everything else first and leaving your japa for last, when you try to change, your mind is really going to battle you for a while. But after a while, it'll give up. It's just like with your children. If you give in to them when they're whining, you train them to whine. But if you never give in to them when they're whining, after a while, they just won't whine anymore. They'll figure out it doesn't work. So the mind is kind of like a little child. And if you get into a habit of saying, you know, my dear mind, we'll do all of these things after we finish our japa, then after a while the mind will be quiet. It'll wait. It'll learn to. It'll have learned that it needs to wait. But the more you give into it, the more it'll be insistent with you. Anything else?
Is that chanting?
Okay, sadhana is shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu smaranam, archanam, dasyam, bandhanam, sakyam, atmanivedanam. So, those are the nine processes of bhakti which Rupa Goswami has expanded into. How many items? Did Rupa Goswami take the nine and expand it to 64? So Rupa Goswami gives us 64 items of bhakti, which can be categorized in the nine. Of the nine, he says three are the most important and five are the most powerful. What are the three most important? Having a spiritual master, serving a spiritual master, and taking initiation from a spiritual master. And the five most potent are? Chanting the holy name, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and other scriptures, staying in a holy place or making your home a holy place, deity worship and association of devotees. So those are the main items of bhakti. Now, sadhana bhakti means bhakti done before perfection, but those are also the things done in perfection. So those are the ways of developing love and expressing love. Both. So there are ways of developing love or awakening love and expressing love that's already awakened. So that means they've done a different level of consciousness. Now what Srila Prabhupada has done is he's taken those 64 items who can be categorized into nine categories, and especially those five most potent items, and he has systematized them into a morning program, following in the footsteps of how previous acharyas and sadhus have done those nine items. Because you could take those nine items or 64 subcategories and do them in many different ways, right? So he's taken them and said, okay, this means you should rise early, you should take a bath, attend Mangalarti, chant at least 16 rounds, three Gayatris in the day, have a Bhagavatam class, worship Tulsi, right? Now, if you look at the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, you'll find that the different devotees and sadhus and acharyas, they may have practiced their sadhana in a slightly different way than that.
He's messing around
with your phone. Like Bhakti Vinod Thakur, he went to bed very early, got up in the middle of the night, and he would write. He'd write and then he would chant his japa. So we find that traditionally, each devotee had, although there's of course regular deity worship, each devotee had their somewhat different way of practicing those nine items of bhakti. We have Haridas Thakur, who was chanting like 192 rounds of japa a day. That was just basically what he did. He also went out preaching. with Lord Nityananda, had some discourses on the Bhagavatam. We had Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who was primarily reading the Bhagavatam. We had Rupin Sanata, who were writing a lot of books. We had Raghunath Das Goswami, who had a certain amount of japa he chanted every day. He was also writing books. He also did Dandavat Parikram of Radhakund Shamakund every day, offered a certain amount of Dandavats every day. So that was part of his sadhana. Now, most of us don't have as part of our sadhana a certain amount of obeisances we offer every day, for example. Although Vandanam, which means both offering prayers and offering obeisances, is one of the 9 items of devotional service. But most of us don't offer obeisances according to a number. Or most of us don't do like a Dandavat Parikram of something on a daily basis. But you'll see some Vaishnavas in Vrindavan. They'll do a Vrindavan Parikram every day, for example. I know one devotee that does a half Parikram of Govardhan every day. So one day she does the one half of Govardhan, one day she does the other. She's been doing that for, of course, sometimes she travels, but when she's in Govardhan, she does that. And of course, some of us have our own deities, and we do some regulated service for our deities every day. And I understand that Srila Prabhupada systematized sadhana in order to have a worldwide movement. And we've seen some other Vaishnavas who've tried, some other Gaudiya Vaishnavas who've tried to preach internationally without doing that. Just kind of saying, okay, everybody can come up with their own system, and they're not as successful. Whereas Srila Prabhupada made, okay, this is the standard sadhana for everybody. Now, of course, the way that Srila Prabhupada established basic sadhana is generally practical if you live in a temple and you're like a brahmachari, brahmacharini. So, you know, to wake up at 3:30 or 4 and have your sadhana go on until 9:30 in the morning is not something most people can do in their homes. If you have a job or your family going to school, you know, to have 4 or 5 hours like that is very difficult for most people. And then the other services that we do during the day, some of those may be within those 9 processes. And some of them are going to be what would normally be our conditional activities that we're offering to Krishna. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So if you weren't a devotee, you're still going to clean your house. You're still going to brush your teeth. You're still going to, you know, get an education. You're still going to have some income. You're still going to have a family. But you're dedicating those to Krishna. You're doing them for Krishna's pleasure. So those may not be exactly the 9 items of devotional service, but they're considered subsidiary functions or supportive functions that can become as good as bhakti when you're also engaged in bhakti. So you can make as much advancement brushing your teeth as you can by reading Srimad Bhagavatam if you're brushing your teeth in that mood of doing it as a service. But it's very difficult to do that if you're not reading Srimad Bhagavatam. And you can't say, you know, you can't, it's not really, it's like the metal put in the fire that then acts like fire. You can't really say that the metal is fire. It's metal. But when you put it in the fire, it acts like fire. So these other activities, when offered to Krishna, in one sense, you can't say they're bhakti, but when you put them in the fire of bhakti, they act like bhakti. So what we call our sadhana bhakti is those 9 processes, particularly the systematized way that Srila Prabhupada asked us to practice them. And again, abhyasa yoga, sadhana bhakti means repetition. So when we refer to our sadhana bhakti, we usually refer to those parts of the 9 processes of devotion that we do on a regular, repeating basis. So I may do certain parts of those items of devotion occasionally. So in one sense, those are part of our sadhana bhakti, but they're not a regular daily program. So I may sometimes go and visit holy places, for example. And of course, some of the 64 items are occasional things, like following Ekadasi or following Janmashtami. Obviously, you can't do that every day. Unless you go from one universe to the next. Have Janmashtami in one universe. One year, we went to 3 Janmashtami festivals in a row. That was interesting.
Did you have to fast for each one?
We didn't. No, it was really interesting. We were driving back to our home from a tour of the United States, and we ended up, we thought we could get back to Detroit in time for Janmashtami, but it just wasn't working. We realized we weren't going to get past Chicago, so we called the Chicago temple and said, can you come for Janmashtami? They said, yeah, it's tomorrow. So great, so we went there for Janmashtami, and then when we called Detroit, they said, oh, our Janmashtami is tomorrow. So in Chicago, we observed Janmashtami, and then we observed Vyas Puja, and then on Vyas Puja day after the feast, we went to Detroit where they were observing Janmashtami. Somehow the line of the different dates went right through. And of course, we couldn't fast on Janmashtami anymore because we already broken our fast for Vyas Puja and had the Vyas Puja. And then the next day in Detroit, it was Vyas Puja. So we were thinking, okay, do we fast half a day for this Vyas Puja? It was a little confusing. And then on Sunday, that temple had this temple in Detroit had another Janmashtami. So we had three Janmashtamis in the morning. I had a funny thing with Ekadasi once, where when I got on the plane, it was Ekadasi. When we stopped in Singapore, it was the time to break Ekadasi. Within an hour of getting back on the plane, it was Ekadasi again. So I wasn't quite sure, you know, when I got off the plane, they said, it's Ekadasi here. I said, I don't know if it is for me, because I think I just broke Ekadasi this morning for me. I wasn't quite sure. I guess if you keep flying around the world, if you keep being Ekadasi. So is that clear about Sadhana Bhakti? It was a long answer. Sorry about that. There you go. Anybody else? Any other questions? Do you have a question already? Were you upstairs?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was wondering how it's, when you take Gayatri Mantra, in second initiation, it's very important cleanliness, but I was wondering how to balance chanting when you just change the dirty nappy, you know, namatis and stuff like that. So
I just gave up.
Oh, I've given up too, so I was
wondering. I decided that being clean with a little baby all the time was impossible.
How can you rap?
That's a good idea. I wish I thought of that. It's a little late for me now. Well, sometimes I still change nappies when I'm with my children and their babies.
And my Guru Maharaj gave me Gayatri when mom was 2 months old, and one of the first things he said to me is just do Ashram.
Okay, that's
it.
That's nice. Yeah, you couldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you had a lot of service.
You have milk tea.
Okay, you know, watch my baby while I go shower.
Does Vishnu have milk tea?
I mean, I remember when my oldest son was a baby, and I got Gayatri Mantra when he was, I guess, 7 months old. And so I started to do deity worship. So I mean, I can still remember, like, giving him a bath and changing his clothes, and then my husband's watching him when I go to the temple, and it's like he's crawling, he wants to come touch me. I'm, no, you can't touch me. No. I really thought the worst thing was being in the temple room with my baby and the pujaris wouldn't want me to touch them. That was sometimes really not very nice. Just the whole mood was kind of weird. I felt like I was a leper. It motivated me to toilet train my children very early. So all three of my kids were toilet trained by the time they were about a year old. Too much. You know, go to the temple, everybody kind of like. Do you have a question, Anya?
What's your question?
Yeah, okay, fine. Anybody else have a question? Yes.
I just wanted to ask, how do you stop yourself when you're in that mode of passion, kind of weak, and, you know, there's a lot going on, and sadhana's not necessarily priority, but what can you do in the middle of all of that to kind of restart again in the correct way? Because it's really hard. That's what I find. If I get into a pattern, it's kind of really hard to stop that pattern.
Okay, 1 second. Yes, Anya? Did you have a question now?
What does Brahma Nuga Bhakti mean?
That's my favourite question.
Well, can you come a little closer? Okay, what does Raganuga Bhakti mean? It means when you're trying to become a Ragatmika devotee. And what does Raga mean? Anybody know what Raga means?
Attachment.
When you just love Krishna so much, that you love him so much, that even if he calls you to come in the middle of the night and there's tigers, you'll still go. And before Raganuga Bhakti, if Krishna calls you in the middle of the night and there's tigers, you say, sorry, there's tigers, I can't go. But Raganuga Bhakti, even if there's tigers and it's dark out and it's a forest, when Krishna calls you, you'll still go. Because you dislike Krishna so much. So you tell me now, Anya, what's Raganuga Bhakti?
It means to chant Krishna's name.
Well, it does, but that wasn't what I said. What will you do in Raganuga Bhakti? Will you go to see Krishna if there's a tiger?
Yes.
If you're not in Raganuga Bhakti, will you go to see Krishna if there's a tiger?
Yes.
No, you won't.
I will.
No, you get scared of the tiger.
No, I'm not scared of anything.
All right, so how do you get back to a standard when you've gotten out of it? You know, you've developed a bad habit. How do you break a bad habit? Have I ever taught you guys the 8 ways of breaking a bad habit? Sometimes I teach this in relationship to training children. But it's also in relationship to yourself. Let's see if I can remember all of them. So the first way is you destroy the situation. So you give away your computer. Actually, you destroy the situation. You move to a new place. Move in the ashram, sell your house, quit your job. One devotee was saying to me that he wanted to take all of his electronics and get them out of his house and put them in an office. So in his house there were no distractions. Unplug your television. Give your television to the thrift shop. So that's to destroy the situation. Okay, next thing is punishment. By the way, destroying the situation sometimes, it always works, but the price is high. And sometimes it's appropriate. Next thing is punishment. So punish yourself. Feel bad. Feel guilty. That works sometimes. But generally, it just... generally, punishment just has you associate bad feelings with your Krishna consciousness. So if every time you think about your japa, you feel guilty, you're going to be less likely to chant japa than if you don't. Does that make sense to you? The Christian writer C.S. Lewis describes this so beautifully. He talks about if you've been negligent in your prayer and your general behavior with Krishna, that then you'll feel embarrassed. You'll have negative feelings about yourself. And instead of just facing up to them and going to Krishna and saying you're sorry and repenting, if you just feel bad, you'll end up avoiding Krishna more. It's like if you owe somebody money and you don't have the money to pay them, and then you just don't want to see them. You won't write to them, you won't talk to them, you'll cross the street. And what you really should do is just go up to them and say, look, I'm really sorry, I know I borrowed this money, but I just can't pay it, what are we going to do? So punishment doesn't usually work really well. I was talking to a devotee, actually in London, some years ago, who said that she'd gotten bad about getting her rounds finished. And she said the problem is that she's so overwhelmed with guilt. And so again, every time she thinks, oh, I have rounds to chant, she would just feel bad. And pretty soon she's associating her rounds with feeling bad. And it's getting harder and harder and harder. And I said, what you should do instead is celebrate the rounds you have done instead of beating yourself over what you haven't gotten done. And I said, just like today, how many rounds have you gotten done? She said, oh, I have 4 left. So anyway, the second way to change bad behavior is punishment. It works occasionally in certain circumstances, but as a general rule, it's very ineffective. Another is what's called negative reinforcement. Negative reinforcement is like punishment, but it only happens when you're doing the bad habit, and then as soon as you stop the bad habit, it goes away. So if every time you're doing something, instead of your sadhana, if you just, you know, tell yourself, I shouldn't be doing this, this is bad, and as soon as you do the right thing, you stop beating yourself up about it. That also is not so effective, although it's more effective than punishment. Then the next thing is what we call shaping the absence of the behavior. So that's rewarding yourself whenever you don't get distracted. And those rewards should be for little things, little accomplishments. What we sometimes do with ourselves and with others is we feel that we can't give any kind of reward until we've accomplished everything that we want to do. But it's just not how we're designed. So just like with little children, when little children learn how to walk, you don't wait until they're running around the house before you reward them. You give them some kind of recognition just for standing up for a few seconds. That's just natural. It's not you have to plan it. You know, when your child first stands up for a few seconds, you're naturally happy about it. I mean, reward doesn't mean like money or candy, but you just go, oh, wow, you're standing up, you know. And the kid immediately falls down. And you don't say, oh, you only stood up for a few seconds, you know, what's that? And the next time they stand up for a few more seconds. And the next time they can stand it without holding on to something. And, you know, and they keep falling down and getting bruised. But you celebrate any little incremental progress that they make. And you tell your family, and the child gets very excited also about it. So it's another thing you can do is really celebrate any kind of progress that you make. Okay, well, today I chanted 2 rounds attentively. Or I got up 10 minutes earlier. Or I chanted 5 rounds before I got distracted. Very good. You know, something. See, we're afraid that if we do that we'll just get weak. We're afraid that if we give ourselves any credit for anything, that then, oh, we'll just be satisfied with that and we won't do any more. And so we have to withhold any kind of reward for ourselves until we've got it all right. But that's just not how we work. We'll just get discouraged. Okay. Then the next is putting the bad behavior on cue. So that is, you allow yourself to do the bad behavior, but you allow yourself to do the bad behavior only at certain times under certain kinds of stimulus. So the whole, by the way, Krishna uses all these things. So the scriptures are full of this. Like, you know, you can eat certain kinds of meat if you sacrifice them to the goddess Kali at a certain time of the month. You can have sex in marriage and under these circumstances. Right? So there's, or with children we do this. We say, okay, now it's playtime, you can go run and scream. Or here's finger paint, you can make a mess on the paper. So we understand that to just stop the bad behavior entirely may be very difficult. Like I had someone coming to me recently and telling me that they were really having trouble with television, that every day they were watching Indian soap operas. And that, you know, I'm sure television is harming my spiritual life. I said, yeah, I'm sure it is. But I said, can you just give it up entirely? And she said, I don't think so. I said, well, maybe you can watch television 3 times a week and watch documentaries. I said, at least watch something that has some value instead of watching utter rubbish. You know, I said, instead of watching utter rubbish 7 hours a week, watch something valuable 3 times a week. Somehow, you know, say, okay, if the mind says, oh, I want to watch television, say, well, you've got Wednesday night from 6 to 7, you can watch the Discovery Channel, whatever it is. And you put the bad behavior on the cue. And then what you do is you start reducing the times that you give the cue. And eventually the bad behavior will extinguish entirely. It also takes a lot of the kick out of bad behavior. It takes a lot of the thrill out of it when you put it on the cue. Let's see if I remember the other ones. Train an incompatible behavior. So get yourself to do some behavior that's incompatible with the bad behavior. Let's see. So let's say you have a problem at a certain time of the day. Do something radically different at that time of the day. Go to the temple, go to a friend's house. Turn on a video of Srila Prabhupada. Something that makes that bad behavior incompatible. In other words, substitute something else for that bad behavior. That you can't do the bad behavior and something else at the same time. Oh, another one is this extinction. Just wait for it to go away naturally. Some bad behavior goes away naturally. Like some of the bad behavior of the children will go away naturally as they grow up. You don't have to do anything. So some of our material attachments will just go away naturally by the practice, by the process of bhakti. You really don't need to deal with them. You know, we don't need to smash and eliminate and pulverize every single one of our bad behaviors and bad attachments. You just don't. You know, this really isn't the anartha destroying movement, it's the Krishna attachment movement. And if you get more and more attached to Krishna, other things will go away by themselves. So some things you can ignore. Okay, and the last one is the most powerful one. And that is find what the need is and satisfy it in another way. Why am I doing this bad behavior? Why am I doing this thing I don't want to do? What need of mine is it needing? That's the only one that really gets to the root. All the others are basically superficial. That doesn't mean the others are useless, by the way. Sometimes as devotees, we think we always have to get to the root. That's not true. You know, you can just, when a bank or a shop or, you know, an airport, they set up some kind of ropes to put people on the queue, and it works. So sometimes just making an external physical change is sufficient. You don't always have to get to the deep behavior patterns. But think, you know, why am I doing this? What need in my life am I fulfilling by this? Do I have a more need for community and socializing? Is there some other way I can meet that need? Is this my need to do something meaningful and valuable with my life? Yeah, is there another way I can meet that need that's not going to be interfering with what I really want? Do I have a need for entertainment and fun? You cannot just go on and 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 on without any recreation. You just can't do it. So, you know, maybe I have a need for fun and for play, which is, I mean, that's all Krishna does, and we're part of him. So we also we need to play and have fun. So maybe I need some Krishna conscious fun. So some other way I can meet that need. I mean, I don't know the particular situation you're talking about. It's not important for me to know, but you can look at that also. So this applies to if you want to change someone else's bad behavior, change bad behavior in yourself. We probably take one more and then we should end. Anybody else? Yes?
Does this following a strict sadhana, does that automatically help you to pass the test during the day? Cause sometimes I find that because during the day your mind gets affected and it affects the following day sadhana. So how do you balance that?
Well, strict sadhana doesn't only mean doing the externals every day without fail. It also means with attention and with care and with love. And definitely having regular sadhana that's attentive with some affection for Krishna. It gives you clarity and vision. It gives you determination. It gives you determination that's not affected by your external situation. So definitely. That's the whole idea. That by absorption in Krishna, that one becomes indifferent to happiness, distress, honor and dishonor, fame and infamy, failure and success. Otherwise, without that attachment connection to Krishna, we're just swept away by these waves of the modes, and we think our happiness is dependent on these things. So without that connection with Krishna, being equal poised and detached in the difficulties of life is just something imaginary. Oh, I'm going to be equal poised. And then when something heavy enough comes along, you can't do it. We can only do it if we have our internal relationship with Krishna. How are we going to do that without bhakti? Bhakti is how we develop our internal relationship with Krishna. So thank you very much. I hope this was helpful for everybody. And please just take on board that which you can use. I'm sure some of the things I said aren't relevant to some of your particular life. So please just take on the parts of it that work for you. Thank you very much. All the best to you.